Continue this morning with our fall series in the book of Deuteronomy. Moses is gathered with the second generation of Israel after the Exodus from Egypt. They are on the edge of the promised land, and Moses is now preaching to them. This morning, Moses tells the second generation the account of what happened when the previous generation, 38 years earlier, had been brought by God to the edge of the promised land themselves. With that in mind, we turn to our text, Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 19 through 46. I do apologize through my own typo. We cut the last few verses of the passage off for you. But as we turn to that passage now together, please do listen carefully. This is God's word for us this morning. Moses says, "Then we set out from Horeb and went through all that great and terrifying wilderness that you saw, on the way to the hill country of the Amorites, as the Lord, as Yahweh our God, commanded us. And we came to Kadesh Barnea, and I said to you, 'You have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which Yahweh our God is giving us. See, Yahweh your God has set the land before you. Go up, take possession, as Yahweh the God of your fathers has told you. Do not fear or be dismayed.' Then all of you came near me and said, 'Let us send men before us, that they may explore the land for us and bring us word again of the way by which we must go up and the cities into which we shall come.' The thing seemed good to me, and I took 12 men from you, one man from each tribe, and they turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol and spied it out. And they took from the land from their hands some of the fruit of the land and brought it down to us and brought us word again and said, 'It is a good land that Yahweh our God is giving us.' Yet you would not go up, but rebelled against the command of Yahweh your God. And you murmured in your tents and said, 'Because Yahweh hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hands of the Amorites to destroy us. Where are we going up? Our brothers have made our hearts melt, saying, "The people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. And besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there." Then I said to you, "Do not be in dread or afraid of them. Yahweh, your God, who goes before you, will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes, and in the wilderness, where you have seen how Yahweh, your God, carried you, as a man carries his son all the way that you went until you came to this place. Yet in spite of this word, you did not believe Yahweh your God, who went before you in the way to seek you out a place to pitch your tents in fire by night and in the cloud by day to show you by what way you should go. And Yahweh heard your words and was angered, and he swore, 'Not one of these men of this evil generation shall see the good land that I swore to give to your fathers, except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. He shall see it, and to him and to his children I will give the land on which he has trodden, because he has wholly followed Yahweh. Even with me, Yahweh was angry on your account and said, "You also shall not go in there. Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, he shall enter. Encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. And as for your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your children, who today have no knowledge of good or evil, they shall go in there. And to them I will give it, and they shall possess it. But as for you, turn and journey into the wilderness in the direction of the Red Sea." Then you answered me, "We have sinned against Yahweh. We ourselves will go up and fight, just as Yahweh our God commanded us." And every one of you fastened on his weapons of war and thought it easy to go up into the hill country. And Yahweh said to me, "Say to them, 'Do not go up or fight, for I am not in your midst, lest you be defeated before your enemies.' So I spoke to you, and you would not listen. But you rebelled against the command of Yahweh and presumptuously went up into the hill country. Then the Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do and beat you down in Seir as far as Hormah. And you returned and wept before Yahweh. But Yahweh did not listen to your voice or give ear to you. So you remained at Kadesh many days, the days that you remained there." This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
All people are like grass, and all their glory is like the flowers of the field. The grass withers, the flowers fall, but the word of the Lord endures forever. Let's pray. Lord, like the psalmist, when we think of the direction that you give us through your ancient word, we take comfort, Lord. Let your word be now our joy and our delight as we attend to it here in your house, so that we would remember your revelation as we go from here day and night, that we may cling to and follow it. Give us that great blessing of walking in your ways by the power of your Spirit. Grant this, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Our text this morning tells us of the failure of the first Exodus generation of Israel to enter the Promised Land. And Moses presents that failure as two different acts of rebellion that are rooted in the same problem. Twice, Moses says that Israel rebelled against the command of Yahweh, using the very same wording. First, he says it in verse 26 when they refused to go into the land. And then he says it again in verse 43 when they insisted on going into the land. It's the same phrase there in Hebrew. Moses is pointing out two forms of rebellion against God. But then, along with that, in this passage, he also points a way forward, which we'll also consider together. And as we come to this text, we need to remember that this story would not have been news to the second Exodus generation, those whom Moses is speaking to in the original context. These events had happened roughly 38 years earlier. Some of Moses' audience were children when these events occurred. But even those who were born after these events, even for them, they would have been stories that they had heard from others. They knew as they grew up why they were wandering in the desert. In a similar way, this story isn't news to most of us. If we have read what Moses has written so far, then we've seen that this story is already recorded in Numbers 13 and 14, and recorded there with more detail. And so we would know already at this point what's happened. And so we're reminded that Moses' point here is not to provide new information so much as it is to warn the second generation of two possible temptations that they will face, and to urge them towards a different way forward, in contrast with what the previous generation had done. So let's then this morning consider how these patterns play out in our text, and then after that, how they play out in our lives. So first, how do these patterns play out in the text itself, in these Exodus generations? We begin with the first pattern of rebellion that we see here, the pattern of faithless despair. And we see that in verses 26 to 33. Before those verses, Moses and Israel had come to Kadesh Barnea at the edge of the Promised Land. They sent in spies. They see that the land is good. They're reminded that God has promised to give the land to them. And then, in verse 26, Israel refuses to go in. Why do they refuse? Well, they tell us in verse 28. They say, "The people are greater and taller than we. The cities are great and fortified up to heaven. And besides, we have seen the sons of the Anakim there." The sons of the Anakim were apparently people of unusual stature. In fact, the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament commonly used later on in the ancient world, translates it as giants. They exclaim, essentially, that the land is filled with giants and with impenetrable fortresses. And they can't compete with that. It's even more vivid in the account in Numbers. There we read the report of the spies who said, "The land through which we have gone to spy it out is a land that devours its inhabitants. And all the peoples that we saw in it are of great height. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, whom came from the Nephilim, and we seemed to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seemed to them." "There are giants in the land and impenetrable fortresses," they exclaim. Interestingly, Moses doesn't seem to contradict those facts. The facts are not really the issue in that sense. The issue is what they will do with those facts. And Israel takes its key turn at this point. They begin their interpretation of the situation in verse 27 with the words, "Because Yahweh hated us." Because Yahweh hated us, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to give us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. The rest of the sentence matters, but in some ways you could really stop with that first phrase, because Yahweh hated us. As one commentator notes, faithlessness results from and is expressed in faulty vision. And what we have here is a seriously faulty vision leading to serious faithlessness and serious accusations against God. In their sin, Israel attributed to God the opposite motive for his actions than what it actually was. And they would hear no alternative to that interpretation. When Moses urged them to a different perspective in verses 29 through 31, they refused to listen, as we read in verse 32. In the parallel account in Numbers 14, the tension is described as even higher. There we read that the people respond to Moses by discussing the idea of calling a new leader in order to take them back to Egypt. And then when Joshua and Caleb urge the people not to rebel, but to obey God's call to enter the land, we read in Numbers 14:10, "Then all the congregation said to stone them with stones. But the glory of Yahweh appeared at the tent of meeting to all the people of Israel." The people were ready to kill those who urged them to obey the Lord, and God himself had to visibly show up in order to stop them. And yet, even when God visibly showed up, they still didn't trust him. Even though they had seen for themselves what God did in Egypt, where God had defeated a much more powerful force, even after witnessing that, they would not trust him. We need to be clear here. Israel did not lack evidence. Their lack of faith was a heart issue. It was a spiritual issue. They looked at the challenge that was before them, and they concluded that God must hate them. In response to their faithless accusations and rebellion, God in his mercy did not revoke his promise or his covenant from Israel as a whole. But he did declare that that generation would not receive its fulfillment. The gift of the land would instead go to the next generation. The people had brought destruction and suffering on their own heads. But in the process, they'd also brought trials into the lives of others. We see this, for example, in verse 37. We might be confused by this verse if we've read the earlier account in Numbers. After all, there we read that God's exclusion of Moses from the Promised Land came much later than Israel's refusal to enter the land. And it was based on Moses' actions, on Moses' sin. And so how could Moses say in verse 37 that he was kept from entering the land on their account? Daniel Block helps solve this for us. The answer, he writes, is actually quite simple. If the Israelites had trusted Yahweh at Kadesh Barnea and entered the land at his command, the events recorded in Numbers 20, in which Moses sinned, would never have occurred. Moses, we see in the other text, was responsible for his actions. But Israel, in their sin, created the trials and the temptations that later provided the opportunity for Moses' own sin. Rebellion against God doesn't usually only hurt us. It usually hurts others as well. In their faithless despair, the first Exodus generation believed a terrible lie about God. They rebelled against God and they brought trouble and suffering on themselves and on others. That is the pattern we see in the text of faithless despair. But somewhat shockingly, this generation does not end the rebellion at that point. In the verses that follow, they switch to another form of rebellion and faithlessness. They switch to faithless presumption. And we see this pattern in verses 41 through 45. The first generation hears the judgment that will come to them, and they panic. And then they swing to what looks like the opposite response, though in the end, its root is the same. After a superficial confession, Israel takes matters into their own hands. And from the middle of verse 41, Moses writes, "And every one of you fastened on his weapons of war and thought it easy to go up into the hill country. And Yahweh said to me, 'Say to them, do not go up or fight, for I am not in your midst, lest you be defeated before your enemies.' So I spoke to you, and you would not listen. But you rebelled against the command of Yahweh and presumptuously went up into the hill country. Then the Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do and beat you down in Seir as far as Hormah. And you returned and wept before Yahweh. Here, Israel follows a very different course of action, but the common thread is that once again, in a lack of faith, they neglect their utter dependence on Yahweh. We ourselves will go up and fight, we read in verse 41. They thought it easy, we read after that. And though God said to them in verse 42, "Do not go up or fight, for I am not in your midst," still they describe what they were doing as acting just as Yahweh our God commanded us. And of course, the fatal flaw was to think that they could go out to fight without God with them. Their willingness to go, even after what he had said to them, that he would not be with them, shows their lack of dependence on him and their sin of faithless presumption. Rebelling against God by ignoring him and by deciding that they could do on their own what he told them they could not do without his help. And in their rebellion and their faithless presumption, Israel once again fails. They are defeated. Even though we can assume that they went out with the same military numbers then that God had commanded them to go out with a few verses earlier, still they are utterly defeated because they went out without God's help. And they were never going to defeat their enemies without God. Only through him was victory possible. And so, in the first generation, we see first the pattern of faithless despair, and then we see the pattern of faithless presumption. Finally, we see the alternative path that God's people were called to instead. And what we see is that God's people are called to faithful dependence on the Lord, rooted in a vision that looks back to see God's past care, and then looks forward in faith, trusting that God will keep his promises. Let me say all of that once more. God's people here we see are called to faithful dependence on the Lord that's rooted in a vision that first looks back to see God's past care and then looks forward in faith, trusting that God will keep his promises. And we see that pattern in three places in our text. First, we see it in Moses. Moses points them back. First, he reminds them of what God did in Egypt, bringing plagues on the powerful nation to deliver Israel, all of which, Moses says to them in verse 30, was done before your eyes. Then he points them to God's care for them in the wilderness so far, his protection of them in the great and terrifying wilderness, as he calls it in verse 19, where he says to them in verse 31, "You have seen how Yahweh your God carried you, as a man carries his son, all the way that you went until you came to this place." God has shown his fatherly care for Israel in the past salvation that he's given them. How then could they doubt his future care and deliverance? It was true that the giants and the fortifications in the land looked insurmountable, but so had Egypt. So had the Red Sea and the wilderness, yet God had overcome those enemies and those obstacles. He had kept his promises in the past, and so they should go forward into the land, trusting that God would continue to keep his promises in the future. Granted, God's promises did not mean that things would be easy. God was not promising Israel ease if they just believed. But he was promising them ultimate success. He was promising them a place and a final victory and a central role in God's work in the world. Some of them would die in battle, even with God's presence and help, but they would die in his care, and they would receive their reward and would have played the part God called them to in his great mission in the world. God had carried them in the past like a father carrying his son, and so they should trust his fatherly care and go forward to what God had called them to, confident in his promises. And in Joshua and Caleb, we see what that looks like. They're mentioned just in passing in verses 36 and 38, but in Numbers 14, they urge the people, saying, "Do not fear the people of the land, for they are bread for us. Their protection is removed from them, and Yahweh is with us. Do not fear them." Moses and Caleb and Joshua show us that faith in the face of serious challenges is possible. It is possible to move forward in humble dependence on the Lord despite the giants, despite the fortified cities. And the way to do it is by remembering God's past faithfulness and his current promises. We see that in Moses, we see that in Caleb and Joshua, but we maybe see it most of all in the second Exodus generation. That again is the generation of Israel that Moses is speaking to in these words that are recorded here in Deuteronomy chapter 1. And we should note a couple things about the relationship between this second generation that Moses is speaking to and the first generation that Moses is speaking about. First of all, Moses stresses that they were deeply connected. And we see this by his use of the word you throughout this passage. Now, remember, Moses is speaking to the second generation. They were all under the age of 20 or unborn when these events played out. The first generation that made those decisions being recounted is now dead. And yet, Moses looks at the second generation and he speaks to them as if they had done it. In verse 20, he says, I said to you. Verse 22, then all of you came near me and said. Verse 26, yet you would not go up. Verse 27, and you murmured. Verse 32, yet in spite of this word, you did not believe Yahweh your God. Verse 43, you would not listen, but you rebelled against the command of Yahweh and presumptuously went up. Moses speaks of the connection between the second generation and the first by speaking to them as a unified body. But at the same time, he also speaks of them as distinct from the first generation. In verse 39, Moses quotes God's words to the first generation, and he said to them, "As for your little ones, who you said would become a prey, and your children who today have no knowledge of good or evil, they shall go in there. And to them I will give it, and they shall possess it." All of those standing before Moses as he preached this sermon were part of those described as a separate second generation. They were either under 20 years old when these things happened, or they had not yet been born. And so Moses also makes a distinction between them and the first generation. What do we take from all of this? Well, first, Moses, in stressing the second generation's solidarity and corporate unity with the first generation, is reminding them that they can make the same mistake, that they too are capable of responding in faithless despair or faithless presumption. Second, by distinguishing between the generations, Moses is holding out to them a call to something different and reminding them that something different is possible. Third, Moses is reiterating the promise God has made to give them the land, a promise that's not just made to Israel in general at this point, but which has been specifically given now to this second generation in verse 39. And fourth, Moses was again encouraging them to look back and to see God's past care and then to go forward following God's calling in dependent faith on the Lord, trusting that he will keep his promises. In that way, really, the whole text is written on the premise that such faithful dependence on the Lord is possible. And so, in our text, when faced with giants and enemy fortresses, there is a temptation to faithless despair or faithless presumption, both of which are rooted in a false memory of what God has done and a refusal to depend on him in trust. Instead, God calls us to look back and to rightly remember God's past care. And then he calls us to step forward in faith and in dependence on him. That's what we see in our text. And we see that same pattern. We see those same temptations and that same calling in a variety of places in our own lives as well. We see those same dynamics on a cosmic level, on a personal level and on an ecclesiastical level, on the level of the church. First, let's consider how this plays out on the cosmic level. If you are a Christian, one good way to start evaluating how you relate to this cosmic challenge is to ask, how much time do you spend thinking about Christ's second coming. When you see the brokenness and the evil of this world, how often is your response something like, but you know what? Christ will come back, and when he does, he will defeat all of this. In our thinking, we can have a tendency to reduce Christ's kingdom and his reign to our hearts or to our minds. Christ is at work within us, but we don't expect much from him in the world. Christ may help us emotionally, but once we turn outward, then it's up to us, which will lead us either to faithless despair in the world or faithless presumption. Because the world is filled with giants and with enemy fortresses. And when we see them, the temptation is either to despair because we seem like grasshoppers when compared to the problems that are around us, or to think it an easy thing to fix this world and to grasp at a quick worldly solution that we think will make all things right. When you look at the world, where do you see most clearly the brokenness and the darkness? Where do you see the giants and the enemy fortresses? And when you see them and they make you feel small, what do you then tend to do? Do you look to a man-made solution and place your trust there, like the Israelites did when they strapped on their swords and thought it an easy thing to go into the hill country? Do you despair and withdraw and doubt God's goodness and care like the Israelites when they declared that it was because Yahweh hated them that he had brought them to that place? Our calling instead is to faithful dependence on the Lord, that's rooted in a vision that looks back to see God's past care and then looks forward in faith, trusting that God will keep his promises. Looking back, we are reminded that Christ has come. He has entered this world, drawing close to us and taking on our sin and suffering so that we might be redeemed. And if he has really done that, then how can we doubt his love? Looking back, we are also reminded how in his first coming, Christ showed his power, raising the dead, healing the sick, confronting evil spirits, and then ultimately in his death and his resurrection, overcoming sin and death and the devil. And if he could do that, then how can we doubt that he can also overcome the giants and the enemy fortresses that we see in this world? And having looked back at what he has done, we are then to look forward to his promises. And what is Christ's cosmic promise to us? Well, the Apostle John gives it to us in the form of a vision in Revelation 21. There he describes what God promises to bring about at Christ's return. And we read this. John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away.' And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.' Also he said, 'Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true.'" When you see the challenges of this life, and when you're tempted to despair or to presumption in the face of the brokenness and the evil of this world, how often do you turn instead to this promise? That is your calling. When you see the cosmic giants and strongholds in this world, you are to remember what Christ has done in his first coming. And then you are to go forward trusting in his promises of what he will do in his final coming. But God's promises do not stop there, because we also need to apply them on a personal level. And this can take place when we face internal challenges or external challenges. Let's briefly consider the internal challenges this morning. Sometimes the challenges that we face, the giants and the strongholds that we see, are internal. that may take the form of sin in our hearts, of sinful patterns that we cannot seem to overcome, sinful temptations that seem to us to be insurmountable. Other times, they take the form of brokenness in our hearts, wounds caused by the sins of others, or struggles caused by the fallenness of this world, which can feel overwhelming and overpowering. When we see those internal challenges, they can feel like giants and enemy fortresses in our hearts, and we can feel like grasshoppers before them. And we again face the temptation to faithless despair or to faithless presumption. On the one hand, we may presumptuously assume that we can fix ourselves on our own. By sheer force of will, we will overcome those internal deficiencies. We can think it an easy thing to go up into the hill country of our hearts. Other times, we see the giants and the strongholds, and we give up. We simply retreat. We let them keep the territory of our heart, and we resign ourselves from any hope of seeing their defeat. But God again calls us to look back and to remember and then to look forward in faithful dependence. Christ has overcome our sin and guilt. He has nailed it to the cross and defeated it so that we are no longer slaves to sin. And he has overcome sin and brokenness on the cross. And so he can easily overcome it in our hearts as well. The Apostle Paul says, "I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ." Christ began that work when he called us to himself in faith, and he will complete it at his second coming, but he continues that work in us now, putting sin to death in our hearts and healing that which is broken. And looking back to what he has done and trusting in his promise, we are to bring our sin and to bring our wounds and our brokenness to him, in faithful dependence on him, seeking the victory that only he can give. Now, we should be clear that none of that is a call to passivity. It's rather a call to actively fight our sin and actively seek healing for our brokenness. But it's a call to active work that depends for everything on Christ. The Apostle Paul summarizes it like this in Ephesians 6. He writes, "Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm." We can see this on the cosmic level. We can see it on the personal level. Finally, we see it as well on the ecclesiastical level, on the level of the church. It is common for God's people to look out at the challenges that the world presents to the church and to see giants and enemy fortresses lined up against the church, and then to be tempted to either faithless despair or faithless presumption. As we considered a few weeks ago, Christ has commissioned his church in a way that is not unlike how he commissioned Israel in our text. In Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 20 and 21, the Lord called the people to take the land. In Matthew 28, verses 18 to 20, the Lord looked at the church and said to them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations." And he added at the end, "Behold, I am with you always, to the end of the age." But when we see the giants and the enemy fortresses of the world, we can be tempted to faithless despair or faithless presumption. And that can take a range of forms. Sometimes in presumption, we go out trusting in ourselves, in our brains, or in our willpower, or in our grit, that on our own we can advance the kingdom. Other times in presumption, we can withdraw, convinced that if we set up the perfect cloistered kingdom, then we will keep the giants out forever. Sometimes in despair, we withdraw, giving up on the commission Christ has charged us with, afraid to be devoured by the world. And still other times in despair, we can go out accepting the ways of the world, accepting spiritual defeat, and surrendering ourselves or our children to the world. Temptations to faithless despair and faithless presumption can take many forms. But God calls us instead to look back at what he has done. Yahweh called a childless couple and promised to make them into a great nation. And despite all of the obstacles that came up, despite all the enemies that came, God did that. He made Israel. Christ called a handful of men and women and commissioned them to make disciples of the nations. And despite all the challenges, despite all of the giants, despite all of the hostile strongholds, the church marches on, making disciples, conquering not only hearts, but sometimes nations. So that right now, there are over 25 times more people who identify themselves as Christians alive today than there were human beings living in the entire Roman Empire in the days of the apostles. Over 25 times more. Jesus said to his apostles that the gates of hell would not prevail against his church, and as we look back, we can see that they have not. And so why do we fear? Why do we presumptuously turn to ourselves? Our calling, instead, in faithful dependence on the Lord, is to obey his calling to be his church dependent on him, both when we are gathered together in worship and when we are sent out into the world in mission. Despair and presumption can often come to us easily, but they require a false vision of the past and a rejection of God's promises for the future. Instead, God calls us to faithful dependence on him, rooted in a vision that looks back to remember what God has done in caring for us before, and then looks forward in faith, trusting that he will keep his promises. Let us therefore look back and see our God as he is, a faithful Father who has lovingly carried us and carried his people thus far. And then, trusting in his love, trusting in his power, and trusting in his promises, let us go out and do the work that he has called us to do. In our hearts, in our lives, and in this world, in faithful dependence on him, trusting that he is with us, and trusting that his presence changes everything. Amen.